and it all started with some hobos in a cloak stabbing pillows.
Well, it started a little further back than that, but yeah, basically.
Nope. At the dawn of time, God said, let there be light, and many pillows were stabbed.
Hi everyone, I'm Faith.
I'm Lewis.
And welcome back to Ramblin' Ramblers. I know I said last month that we were going to start a new system in October, but after some deliberation with Lewis, we've opted to go on a short hiatus to wrap up a campaign and also give me a chance to learn more about the new system that we were going to cover in October. So that said, we're not going to leave you hanging. Because it's Halloween, we are going to visit probably the spookiest monster from Dungeons & Dragons 3rd Edition, which I have no idea what that is, to be totally honest.
I am going to surprise you.
Oh yay, I like surprises.
And do not take clues from my voice, because that is not what we're doing. So, the Flumph, right?
What? I know that. That's not... That's not spooky at all.
Actually, might be. This is a throwaway tangent now, by the way. Immediately straight into tangents of a gag, but... like, the things subsist by psionically vampiring evil brainwaves?
What the Flumph does?
Think so?
Does it?
I'm not sure. Also, that thing on top of its head is not a mouth.
It's a butthole.
Such a bizarre creature. I play DCC, and yet the Flumph is too ridiculous for me.
Should put the Flumph in DCC and see what happens.
I have no idea. I'd have to do so much work on that.
Would you, though?
But we're not here. No, probably not. I've managed to find this perfect balance between working hard and working smart, where I don't have to do either.
I wish I could do that.
Basically, just being called dumb and lazy.
I wish I could do that.
I mean, I could. I wish to.
So
Halloween monsters.
Yes, so what is the spookiest monster? Because you've told me that there's a really spooky monster. And honestly, I feel like it would be kind of hard to top a beholder. Beholders are pretty spooky, especially with how previous editions prior to the 5th edition give birth to baby beholders. Aboleths are pretty spooky. So, like, what's spookier than those?
I think there is a clever distinction to be made between spooky and scary.
Okay, that's fair.
Scary can just be terrifying, and beholders and aboleths are absolutely scary as fuck.
Yes.
But spooky has to be different. It definitely has a theme, and it's definitely not better or worse than anything else. But I never got to write this down, so please bear with me. It is deep winter in Hardbuckler. The Gnomish town has been going through some very strange times of late. Families have been disappearing in the night, some say to have heard screams, but only briefly, assuming their neighbor had simply dropped something, or stubbed their toe, or were surprised by an errant cat. These reports went unminded until the next morning when the neighbor did not rouse the next day. The neighbors were sometimes found later in an alleyway, eviscerated, missing lungs and liver. These were all the calling cards of a serial murderer for many years prior. Thankfully, it could not be the original, for he was hanged. And yet here we have a copycat killer removing the lungs and liver of several victims. There does not seem to be a connection between any of the families, and the ones that aren't killed move on from Hardbuckler unable to remain because of the emotional loss, leaving only just enough gold for their loved one to be buried, and that, everyone thought, would be the end of it. Some weeks have passed since the first killings, and in the week that followed the last killing, the groundskeeper noticed that several graves had been disturbed. Upon inspection, the grave of every single one of the lungless and liverless was missing its inhabitant. The grave was empty, shattered from within, and everyone assumed it was simple zombies. Zombies are not a common occurrence, but they are unknown. And so, an inquisitor was sent to find where these zombies have gone, for normally they would just ramble around aimlessly in the graveyard until put down by anyone with a sharp enough axe. The inquisitor arrived, and he looked around, and he found that they all trailed off southwards towards the reaching woods. Clearly something is afoot, and so he went away. He eventually found the blood of great beasts and claws hanging in the tree bark, but no corpses. This shows all the signs of a necromancer, and so he steals himself and advances forward, expecting to find some grand, hidden wizard's tower deep in the forest. He readies himself with a simple detect magic spell and finds nothing. For several days, he looks. He searches high and low for this invisible tower, but the tracks seem to lead onwards, ever deeper. His hopes for a simple lich or vampire that he could observe in some forgotten noble's manor, some summer house that was built many centuries ago. Instead, he finds the tracks lead to a small cave. It's at this point he realizes it is likely ghouls. For ghouls are not constructive. They inhabit the dark corners, eking out their existence in as quiet a way as they possibly can. Ghouls, however, have their strength in numbers, not skill. And so, drawing his sword, he confidently strides inside the cave, bellowing out a prayer to his deity. The last thing the Inquisitor sees is the roof of the cave swirling around him as he falls onto his back, unable to move. Then, striding into his view from below, he sees the skeletal form of a man with a broken neck. The neck does not connect to the skull, but rather there is a large purple worm, no tentacle, that wraps itself around the arms and insides of what the skeleton has been harvesting. The tentacle protrudes out of the creature's mouth like a great pronged tongue. It is a morgue. A morgue is the corpse of a serial killer whose detestment for life was so great it brings them back from the grave to continue their great work. Envisioning themselves as artists or pioneers in the arts of murder and chaos, they are little more than deranged individuals, cursed to never rest. The last thing he realizes before the creature impales him on his great long tongue is that he will not rest easy. For the victims of a morgue rise themselves as zombies, thralled to its will. And that's it.
I've never heard of a morgue, so I actually really, really like that concept of, you know, someone being so deranged and so and contempt and having so much contempt for life coming back just to end more of it. That's spooky.
Yeah, basically it's not really written anything anywhere in the book, and I've honestly not looked at the Wikipedia for morgues. I have looked, and I saw that it was only in third edition, but I didn't really look into all the details. I don't think there's a lot. I think they've cropped up a couple of times as like not a background character. You know, like the action movies when the silent 7-foot-tall Russian is like given the nod from his boss, and now the hero has to fight the 7-foot-tall silent Russian?
Yes.
And like, he's got no character, but he's the big scary fight, and then they have the big scary fight, and then they have the boss fight. Morgues, I think they've been used that way. I'm actually going to have to look it up now before I commit to an answer here. So apparently they've appeared in one adventure, one short story, two video games, and an organized play or licensed adventure.
So they're used sparingly, which adds to the spookiness.
I don't think they're used sparingly. I think it's just that they require a little bit more attention than simply having a mummy, for example.
Right.
Because we largely know what mummies are. They're big, burly brutes that can take an absolute pounding, and they're from some... In the real life, it's a burial ritual, which then got exaggerated, shall we say, by tomb-delving people, archaeologists mostly.
Yeah.
In more broad fantasy thing, they're cursed to be guardians of their own tomb, or they are entrusted to be the guardians of a tomb. And by upsetting the tomb, you awaken the guardians. And so they're these big blokes that... They're the 7-foot-tall Russians.
They're more common 7-foot-tall silent Russians.
Yeah. The morgue, however, is just a little bit weirder. As I say, the concept only exists in D&D 3. It has made its way into both Pathfinder 1 and Pathfinder 2, I believe, where they did embellish on it a fair bit. But I don't think they changed very much about the baseline of it. Though the concept, I thoroughly enjoy. So, the exact wording on it is, for the creation is, they were the risen corpses of mass murderers and others who'd committed similar crimes and never atoned before they die. And that's straight out of the book. Personality. The entire section reads, morgues had an overriding hatred of all life. Yet, tormented by it, they yearned to live again themselves. And... honestly, this whole thing just reads pretty thin. But one of the things that stands out about them that you do notice first is the fact that they're entire... So they're essentially a skeleton. I believe we are all familiar with the concept of a skeleton, especially a human skeleton. Except all the internal organs don't exist because it's a skeleton. But in their place is this writhing tentacle thing. And it can spit this tentacle out from its mouth like a dart frog or something, which paralyzes its victim. The victim is then paralyzed for 1d4 minutes, at which point it will just set about killing you. And if it is an absolutely deranged serial killer, that could look like them using your paralysis to just surgically remove your lungs and liver. And... in my head, I really like the idea that it requires those things, or some things. Maybe it's just your kidneys. Maybe it's specifically just the heart or something. But it needs that to grow this organic tentacle. This tentacle is an organic thing. It's shown to be slimy. It's shown to be horrible. It's still immune to sneak attacks because it's still an undead creature. But... and it's symbiotic. It's not like it's one thing. It's not just using the skeleton as a frame. The skeleton is that person, and this thing is only just like generating power in it. And so the trade-off here is that it needs to continue doing the thing that it loved in life, killing, to feed this thing that gives it energy to do this thing that it loved in life, killing. And I really like the cycle because it's kind of creepy.
So I pulled up the Forgotten Realms wiki so I could actually see a picture of it. It is, yeah, it's gross. But I also was also reading a little bit too, and I do appreciate that it can only be brought to life or animated using the Create Undead spell, but only by the most powerful of spellcasters.
So, yes, it can be. Create Undead is a really cool spell, And honestly, if I was a necromancer, I'd want a couple of these things around because they're not mindless. They have the same intelligence as your average commoner. So they're not super intelligent. But they have enough intelligence to use skills and not be an absolute idiot. If you have a bunch of skeletons, they're just going to walk around just being big dummy skeletons, which is fair. That's fine. Whereas these things can actually be decent lieutenants, and everyone that they kill will rise as a zombie within 1d4 days.
That's pretty terrifying.
So you could outfit one of these as an undead lieutenant, and because it's intelligent, it can take class levels, it can learn, it can hone its skills, it can refine its craft, and it can amass an army. If one of these was to start gathering a couple of levels of, like, rogue or something, it'll be an absolute stealth nightmare.
I kind of want to fight this thing now.
And that's the other cool thing. They're all challenge rating 8.
That's pretty tough.
Not low.
Yeah.
They have... Oh, I've closed the book. I think it's somewhere in the region of 90 hit points, and I want to say an AC of 20. Vaguely, I'm not opening the book again. So, like, they're actually, honest to God, tough things. And as I said, they have the ability to learn. If you passively have an armor that's around the number of 20, and then you learn how to be a soldier and start wearing chainmail and using a shield, you're a tank. Congrats. They don't have a constitution because they're undead. Their limited intelligence means that they couldn't be great spellcasters. But at the same time, they are intelligent, and thus they can increase their intelligence. So there's no reason it couldn't be a middling spellcaster. It's not going to be a lich parallel. Like, you could use a vampire wizard, or you can use the ghost of a wizard, and those would be good parallels for a lich. And one of the things I like doing myself is, if there is going to be like this faceless lich built up in a story, I like to use a ghost, because ghosts are incorporeal and they work very differently to liches, but they also fill the same role largely. Angry undead. These guys, morgues, won't ever, in my opinion, serve the same role as those creatures. But it will absolutely delightfully set the tone for a less world-ending threat. The encroaching army of undead. Instead of using its magical powers to control and force a bunch of undead to do its things, it's just passively able to make things into zombies. And it doesn't say humanoids.
Oh, it could be anything. So he could just have, like, a bunch of zombie bears.
He could ride into battle on a zombie dragon.
Oh, God.
And you know what? I lied. I'm going to open my book again, because these challenge rating 8. What size black dragon is near challenge rating 8? So we've got juvenile at 7 and young adult at 9. What size are these lovely creatures? Young adult is large. So that would mean that if he had, say, one level of fighter, which would make him challenge rating 9, and then sit him atop a zombie young adult black dragon, which is also challenge rating 9. That's a challenge rating 11 encounter right there.
Ouch.
And he's immune to mind control because he's undead. He's immune to sneak attacks because he's undead. The dragon is immune to sneak attacks because he's undead. They both have a whole bunch of hit points. The dragon itself is largely reduced down to just a big scary lizard because it's undead. It's not intelligent. Whereas the morgue, well, he's now a fighter. He's on the back of a dragon. He knows how to survive. So the first thing he's going to do is he's going to pull out a great big pecking longbow and just wallop you from the sky. Because these things clock in at the same strength that your barbarian hopes to be most of the time.
Oh, jeez.
Their base strength is 20, 21. I've actually found it again. So, you know, they could be using a compound plus 5 bow, which is, you know, a d8 plus 5, which makes it a pretty impressive item to have. It's like 600 gold, I believe. Again, he's a challenge rating 9 creature. He's going to have magical items himself. That's going to be, oh god, a plus 2 bow, easily.
Oh my god.
So, every time he hits you, it's going to be a d8 plus 9.
Jeez.
Which is, you know, fun. This is getting into the numerical side of it a little bit. I would like to keep it more on the creature itself as an idea.
Yeah. Just thinking about that, it's like now it's crossed the threshold from spooky directly into scary when you realize the implications of its ability to make zombies.
Yes. So it's any creature that it touches that will turn into a zombie. So again, zombie dragon, zombie bears, zombie townsfolk. If you don't catch on to this guy kicking around soon, he's gonna build an army. And like, you can absolutely have a campaign around a morgue who, again, they're only intelligence 10 or 11, like the average commoner. But the average commoner knows enough to not just stand there with a neon sign saying, "I is the bad guy, come shank me for XP." And especially in D&D terms, where like they're not portrayed as the uneducated Middle Ages peasant. "Help, help, I'm being repressed." They're not all gong farmers. They're just people. That's what the average peasant is in D&D. They're not particularly swayed one way or another. They're probably quite simple, down to earth, chill people. But a farmer knows how to do crop rotation.
Yeah. So, like, here's the thing: is they may not be like highly educated, but they're not stupid.
No. And given that their quote unquote profession in life was serial killer, they would also know, you know, I should not be very open with this fact. And so you've got this thing that's going to be living in the sewers, or in a cave nearby, or maybe in the basement everyone forgot was in the church. And it will creep out at night, stealthily hunting someone. The town crier at night. The matchstick girl. Whatever. They start off small. Then they have this army of zombies. What do you do with an army of zombies? Well, you invade somewhere. What are you going to do when you invade somewhere? Well, you grab resources. So you've taken over, let's say half a village. So I started with Hardbuckler. Hardbuckler is a place in the Forgotten Realms that I really like. There's not a lot of info on it. It's just a small town that's full of gnomes. And so that's my bias. I like the gnomes.
To be fair, gnomes are pretty great.
But yeah, they could go to the Reaching Woods, the Forest of Worms, and even into the Underdark. The reason they want to go into all these forests in the Underdark is because they're undead, and they have dark vision. They can see you, and you can't see them. You have a light, and then they see you from even further away.
Yeah, because in editions prior to 5th, dark vision was not as prevalent.
No.
So fighting something that has dark vision when you can't see them is terrifying.
But yeah, so the morgue is completely outfitted for stealthily hunting its prey. It doesn't particularly track unique individuals. Like, it doesn't have, like, ranger skills or anything. But it will find a target, and it will sneak up on the target, and it will kill that target. And honestly, I think I'm just sitting here awash with ideas, because we started with the idea of him being a fighter. I'm sitting here now thinking that he becomes a ranger. So the fighter would just be your typical warlord type. The ranger would be less interested in the domination or subjugation of other nations or other places. The ranger would probably be more interested on, I don't know, collecting the skulls of firstborn men. And then, as we said, there's the slightly lower chance of him being a wizard, which it doesn't fill the same role quite as a literal vampire, as he's already challenge rating 8. If he becomes a powerful caster, not really. He's going to be looking at like second level spells when the party is using fifth level spells.
Yeah, but that could still be pretty formidable when he already has an army of zombies that he didn't even necessarily have to try to make.
Oh no, you're absolutely correct. Especially if he gets something like True Strike, a spell which is absolutely fantastic, at which point his tongue almost cannot miss.
Ew. Eh.
And you're standing there and you're... And you might be standing there with like your long spear thinking, I'll stab this guy, I'll keep him from getting close to me, and then his tongue is just as long as that, I think.
Ew. Nah. I got the heebie-jeebies now.
They're not fun creatures. They are cool creatures. And I think this is what I want to maintain is the difference between scary and spooky. So the tongue thing I turned out was to maybe lie. My bad. But I did notice this time around that they have the improved grab feature. Which means that if the tongue doesn't get you, and they strike you with their arm, which they can do in the same round, because they're not reliant on one another, it's literally like spitting at someone before you headbutt them. Glaswegians do it all the time. The creature will then just hold you in an absolute chokehold. And if you're lucky, they'll paralyze you and move on to the next person. If not, they'll just crush all the wind out of you and turn your ribcage into a packet of crisps.
Jesus. They're spooky. I was not expecting, like, I was expecting something spooky, but I wasn't expecting something, like, spooky, if that makes sense.
Oh no, I totally get it. I think this is why they never turned up after third edition.
Well, they should have, because they're great.
I think they're great. I don't know how well the mechanics would work in, especially fourth edition. But mostly because my 4th edition rule is really rusty. And it seems to go against the general design concept of 5th. I was discussing with someone today about the need for evil. And this is a tangent, but I feel it's a very good one. And probably one of the more important tangents I've had. But basically, I feel that in fiction... So in D&D, in your Lord of the Rings, in your little personal books that you're all writing at home, there needs to be an objective evil. There needs to be a Sauron. There's no ifs and buts. Sauron and his Legion of Orcs are evil. There needs to be a ever-present threat from Mind Flayers. With no ifs and buts, they are evil. They need to eat your brain to live. They might not like it, but they still have to, and they're evil. There needs to be undead. Undead need to be evil. Because this means when you start playing with concepts such as someone who was born a sorcerer, for example, and it turns out they have an affinity for necromancy, but they're not a bad person. They don't want to kill people. They don't want to resurrect the dead. And they have to then wrestle with this power they have that isn't a good power, but they want to do good with it. And I feel that sort of story has weight. And also by having an objective evil to rise up against and have the heroes fight, that sets the metric for how heroic those people are. So we have Faith. You're going to correct me on this Lord of the Rings stuff, but I'd really like you to jump in on this. Sauron is the objective evil. Yes?
Yes.
Saruman said, maybe he's not. That means that the virtue value of Saruman is basically none. Correct? Saruman the White.
Yeah, Saruman the White. He's an additional objective evil because of his corruption by Sauron. Which is why...
Yes, sorry, I'll let you continue.
I was going to say because I don't know... Have you read the books yet? I know you've seen the movies, but have you read the books yet?
I haven't read much of the books, no, and not in any time relevant.
Damn, okay. So, do you remember in the movie where they show the Shire on fire and stuff?
You don't?
Okay, you've seen the extended edition where Galadriel's showing Frodo what's happening in the mirror?
And oh, yeah.
When she's showing Frodo the Shire on fire and stuff, that actually happens in the books. The Shire does get burnt to, like, it gets razed. It gets totally decimated. And the reason it gets decimated is Saruman. Saruman becomes the new objective evil at the end.
Aha. Okay. So yes, let it be known, I am much more of the movies guy than I am the book guy. But fortunately, Faith is the book girl, and also the movies girl, and just generally the Lord of the Rings girl.
I get it from my dad.
But yes, to continue, there was Gondor, who... They didn't actively rise up against Saruman, did they? Sauron. Not on their own. They had the... who was he? The Keeper?
Oh, Denethor the Steward?
Yes, the Steward. And he wasn't actively doing stuff against Saruman.
Sauron.
God damn it, Tolkien!
So... No, he wasn't, but that's because Sauron put him in a place of utter madness so that he wouldn't stand up to him. But that's book stuff.
Okay. You're completely ruining my analogy here, Faith.
I'm sorry! You asked me to correct you, so I'm doing that.
But please try and point out places where it's true, too.
So, okay, you are correct. Gondor did not stand up to Sauron because Sauron mucked with the brain pan of Denethor the Steward. Otherwise, Denethor the Steward would have absolutely mustered defenses against Sauron.
And the Westhold?
Oh,
no.
Rohan?
Rohan, yes. Like, they were even further away. They were, like, actively being corrupted. But they also didn't stand up. But they did stand up very quickly when the actual heroes turned up, having marched all the way across the planet. God damn it.
Yep.
And then pointed out and went, hey, villainy's bad, yo. And half of them were like, yeah, we got expelled for saying that, so... Why don't we go tell them that they're wrong and we shouldn't be expelled? And, like, the further you go from there, there's, like, a ripple effect coming out of these heroes. Specifically the hobbits. Specifically Frodo and Sam. Specifically Frodo, to be honest. Sam's absolutely the best character, objectively.
Yes.
But Frodo is the beacon. And as he goes, he casts his light across the world. And as his light illuminates the shadows, they recede. The things it reveals reflect his light, and it just continues outwards from him until, and that's what gets that huge, massive fuck off army to the Black Gate.
Yep.
It's this domino wave that splits out, and it all started with some hobos in a cloak stabbing pillows.
Well, it started a little further back than that, but yeah, basically.
Nope. At the dawn of time, God said, let there be light, and many pillows were stabbed. And then everyone was like, oh, let's sing a heavenly tune about this. And Melkor was like, cool.
Doot, doot.
We were talking about objective evils and how they are vital to storytelling.
This was because there was an interview with Jeremy Crawford a couple of years ago now, I think, where he says that a certain character is neutral because that's how she defines herself, which is a cool statement to make. She did sire the children of a demon prince as she worked on a novel about demons and the control thereof that she wrote on human flesh in blood. But sure, if evil can set its own definition on whether or not it's evil, it just muddies water. And it's always cool when the villain thinks they're doing good, or that they know they're doing something evil, but they think it's for a worthy cause. That's all well and good. There's still evil being done, but it's self-aware at least. Just doing it and describing it as, lols, lamau even, it just cheapens everything else, I feel. And so that's kind of why I wanted to talk about the morgue.
There's no good in them.
No.
There's no neutral in them.
No. Quashing that evil sets a very high metric for the heroes. Like, they've done an objectively good thing by objectively destroying this objectively bad thing. If, for example, nothing really matters, alignment is just sort of a funny thing. As the storyteller, you have to explain extra why specifically this den of kobolds are evil kobolds. And then it's just some kobolds that you beat. It lacks a bit of meaning, I think.
Right.
What do you think of this, Faith? I'm throwing you under the bus because I've run out of time. I've been talking for far too much, and this is a really big topic, and I'm going to make you talk about it without any promptation or planning ahead.
Oh. Go for it. Thanks, man.
I'll be sending this to psychology professors.
Oh, will you now? Well, I don't feel like I have much to add because you and I tend to be on the pretty much the same wavelength.
But you are a storyteller, so you can probably...
I mean, I fancy myself a storyteller, but...
Yeah, I fancy you also as a storyteller, so...
But here's the thing about my stories is that my stories don't actually have an objective evil in them, because really it's most of them are a race against time. There's no explicit bad guy. So I'm not the person to ask about objective evils. I mean, you quiz me on Lord of the Rings and I'll tell you, yeah, okay, this is why these people are evil and why these people are not.
I feel having this... Yeah, this metric to set how villainous a thing is, it really sets a tone. And by using things such as a red dragon, which it is a European red dragon, and European red dragons have always had this stereotype of being powerful, hateful creatures. This goes back God knows how long. The Welsh have pride of it. The British have St. George, who was a dragon killer. It's all over the fucking place. It's all throughout history. D&D continues this by having them being smoggy. The joy here is that I was getting at is that anytime you have a red dragon, that has a preconception in your mind It's going to be large, greedy, fire-breathing. This doesn't mean that they should always be this. Breaking from the stereotype makes something matter, if it matters. If you've just made a red dragon who is a red dragon every possible way, but breathes lightning, that's novel, but it's not really challenging anything.
Right.
I really like that idea. Like, lightning breath, very cool. Definitely going to use it. I'm not looking down on anything here. I'm actually going to start scribbling this out very quickly. but by having this nice, cool metric, you can objectively say, this hero has achieved so much. This is why you level up. The first encounter's with a couple of bandits, then it's a couple of goblins, and then it's a couple of ogres, and then eventually you're fighting God.
Yep.
With a couple of liches along the way. But back to the main point, morgues. Morgues are objectively evil. They are risen from evil magic or evil desires. And it's not simply bad, bad thoughts. It is they long to murder as they murdered their way through life. They didn't. It's not like, what are they called? Revenants, where it's a person who is upset that he was murdered himself, and so he comes to murder his murderer. These are creatures whose soul was tainted before they died. And I find them deeply interesting, deeply disturbing. And most of that is because they sit in this little bubble of challenge rating. And I've come to have two very diametrically opposed opinions of challenge rating. I really love challenge rating as a concept, especially when it works. I don't think there's ever going to be a perfect challenge rating system, but the third edition challenge rating system, I love. It just works. From what I've seen of Pathfinder 1, it also works quite well. I've heard Pathfinder 2's is also pretty on point. But at the same time, I also absolutely love how in a vast majority of games, they don't give a shit. They're just like, here's a giant. If your players decide to fight a giant, that's the encounter now. If they chose to run away from the giant, good. Smart players.
Yeah.
But here's a giant. And it's all down to the players to know that giants are big, strong things. And also pretty fucking evil creatures, because they are very much about the slave trade.
Yeah, that's fair. But morgues.
Yes. But yes, a challenge rating 8, they sit in this really nice bubble because gameplay peters off after a certain point. I'm not aware of any numbers for 3rd edition. And my gut feeling is that this isn't entirely accurate for 3rd edition. But there are numbers for 5th edition where something like 80% of games stop at level 10.
Mm.
Something like that. I'm not looking up the stats now. It's from D&D Beyond, and it's also from like 6 years ago, so time can change stuff. But 8 is this very nice thing, because I used to do this thing where we would play at level 6, because in my mind, level 6 was a really nice level. You got your third level spells, you had some decent hit points behind you, you might have started on a prestige class by now, you might have got a little bit of a multi-class thing going on, and level 6 was like this really nice area to be playing. Years later, I discovered that a lot of people were doing this, and they called it Epic 6 or something. And they would just level lock you at level 6.
Oh yeah, we were talking about that the other day.
Probably. It's come up quite a few times recently. I imagine someone's done a video on it somewhere. But despite the fact I'm a massive 3rd edition fan, I don't listen to a lot of people muse on it. Which is probably a little bit hypocritical, to be honest. But yes, so at level 6, things like mind flayers hold a bit of weight. Mummies are also kind of still bulky and tough. But the morgue sits there as this really nice, tough opponent who is not quite at the lich level. Liches, you won't really see a lich proper until like level 10. You might fight a couple of vampires, you might fight a couple of ghosts, but the morgue just has this extra level to them. And I really do mean this in the politest possible way. Vampires and ghosts can be a little bit trite. And this comes from the guy who will regularly talk like this, which kind of also proves my point. I love them, and there is a wealth of things you can do with them, but like, they're known. You know when a vampire turns up, silver weapons, right?
Yeah.
But a morgue? Well, you didn't know what a morgue was until today.
That is true, and I feel like having that element of the unknown makes it scarier. Or spookier. Borderline scary.
Borderline scary.
Yeah, I think we need more... I think we need more monsters like the morgue where... Well, maybe not more, but...
You want more morgues?
Yeah, I mean, I want enough morgues for them to be like, oh crap, we're encountering a morgue, and that's terrifying. But not so much that they become trite. You know?
Yes.
Okay.
So, I have been a fan of the morgue for years. And you've absolutely hit the nail on the head there. It's because people don't really know what to expect from them. They already have this cool sort of narrative to them. And this is one of the things I love about DCC, which it doesn't really have a bunch of stuff. It just gives you the bare bones of ideas and say, here's stuff, go wild. The idea here being that you don't get bogged down into all the numbers that I love from third edition, but you get to bog yourself down in all the narrative of the things.
Right. That is what makes DCC pretty great. It's rule of cool.
It's rule of cool as written.
Yes.
Which is just fantastic.
Roka.
But this isn't a D&D podcast session. We're doing D&D 3.
Yes.
And we did Morgue.
And we did tangents. We didn't do any puns, though.
I did.
Oh, you did. I might have been parenting.
You wanted more.
Oh, yeah. I wanted more morgue.
Also, I decided that Melkor scat danced, or scat sang, or whatever it's called.
Yeah, he scatted all over the place.
Well, that's not what I meant, but okay. You're not wrong. I was just saying he aggressively jazzed everywhere.
Aggressive jazz intensifies.
And then Faith drops her little bombshell and the jazz music stops.
Yep. Record scratch.
Hey.
What?
That's me. You might be wondering how I got myself into this mess. When it all started. Like an hour ago. Woo! Reba-da-bop-bop-da-bop!
So, that wraps up our episode on morgues and how creepy they are. So, until next time.
Stop adventuring. Suspect the dice. Suffer. And have a happy Halloween.
Heck yeah! See you in a couple months!
Mwah-ah-ah-ah-ah. If you would like to play DCC or any other roleplay game that we mention in this podcast, get in contact with us at Twitter at GrumpyDeck or find our Discord link in bio and pinned comment.
Special thanks to Reichelt for sprucing up our cute little logo and to Tim from TabletopAudio.com for our intro and outro music. We hope you enjoyed this episode and we will see you next time.